I've been having a little trouble with my audio, I think, or maybe a little trouble with myself as to what I think my audio should be. I don't think the sound quality is quite as good.
I think you sound better this week, Johnny.
Do I?
Yeah, much
clearer.
Yeah,
I was going to say the same, yeah.
Ah, that's maybe because I'm sitting closer to the microphone.
There you go, then.
Right, I've got a beard today, which is unusual.
I thought you said you had a beard. It's like, is that going to interfere with things?
Richard, I must, you know, in the interest of full disclosure, I must tell you that I have a beard today.
You do have a beard, right?
I do.
Right, are you working on that?
I absolutely do have a beard.
Is it your beard, or did you borrow it? Or
It is mine.
You know, December beard is long gone now.
Say it again?
December beard.
Is that what it's called?
But it was
it's the follow-on from Movember, is it?
Yeah, December beard. Yeah.
I will never grow a moustache. Whenever I shave, the first bit I shave is under my nose, because I will never have a moustache.
Oh, it was a horrible experience. I will be doing it again. I'll happily donate it to it, but I won't be growing one again.
Jordan's keeping very quiet on this.
Oh, I did Movember once, and I will never do it again. never. I tend to have a beard, but... not a moustache, no. It's not a good look. Not unless you are expected to be on the front cover of The Sun and Crime Watch. Yeah. Then, no.
Okay, I was just about to say, unless you lived in a particular part of the country, but I thought Boris Johnson has already alienated them. I don't need to as well. Right, new approach this week. I've not read any of the links. We'll see how it goes.
It's wicked time.
It is. I hope you two know what you're talking about, because this week I really don't. This is Back to the Mac from the Q Broadcasting Network. You can follow us on Twitter at @BTTMPodcast or at Q Broadcasting. You can find us on the internet at Q.AM. That's Q-U-E.AM. Enjoy the show. Yes, here I am. It's episode 15 of Back to the Mac, and this week I've got Richard Harkness.
Good evening, Johnny.
And back by popular demand, we have Jordan Merrick. Hello, Johnny. Hello. What's been happening in the world of Apple this week, guys? Oh, hang on. We haven't told people what we're about, have we? Yeah.
What the hell's the show?
What the hell is the show? Well, the fact that nothing's been happening in the world of Apple this week means that we've got time just to bring you this. We can tell you what the show is about. It's Back to the Mac. It's a show about Mac stuff. We don't do iOS. All right.
Much better. It's so much cleaner now, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? It's a bit easier to say. Not such a tongue twister. I can't even get out tongue twister because I'm with a Czech blonde this evening again. Apple, has anything happened this week?
Positive wise, not so much so. it feels like every week we're coming on, we're going, yeah, there's a security problem again.
But there's not a security problem anymore, is there, Richard? Because Apple's actually doing something about this whole security issue, aren't they?
I believe so. But the last I read, now you can correct me on this, that somebody said there's still a workaround. To enlighten the listener, the issue has been around, they've found a flaw. Now, is it directly related to this?
Richard, what are we talking about, man?
What?
What are we talking about? Well, what's the subject? Tell us. Put us out of our misery.
There's a problem. I think it's related to when Apple have moved across to two-step verification for your Apple ID. So, and in the process of, I think it's something to do with that anyway, that if if a hacker has got your email address and date of birth, they can get into your Apple ID and cause all sorts of expensive damage with that.
Okay.
So since that came out, Apple initially limited access, I believe, to the password reset button. Then they pulled it completely once the extent of it was known. But now that's back online again, and as far as I understand, they've fixed the problem. But I did read somewhere that somebody said it can still be done, but it's much harder now. I don't know. I think that was on Twitter, so I don't know how true that is.
You can believe everything you read on the internet, Richard.
Absolutely everything, yeah.
This is Apple's new two-step verification system that they introduced on Friday, the 22nd of March, which is a system that enables people to protect their Apple IDs by moving to a different security system than just having questions that you have to answer. Jordan, both Richard and I are clearly floundering here. Can you help us out?
So the two-step verification was brought in. It's probably related to a lot of these kids who are racking up very expensive iTunes bills for their parents. But it's a way to add an extra level of security to your account where you designate a trusted device, so your iPhone, your iPad, whatever. So every time you want to make a change to your iTunes account or you want to make a purchase, you have to not only take your password in, but you have to wait for a four-digit verification code to be sent to your device. Now, companies like Microsoft and Google have been using something like this for a while now. I've not used the iCloud one and the iTunes one yet, simply because mine is still pending. It looks like for whatever reason that Apple have deemed necessary, if you've made a recent change to your account and then you make the request to enable two-step verification, there's a waiting period of 3 days. Now, the change I made was to change my date of birth to avoid people hacking into my iTunes account, so I kind of missed out on that and I still haven't had a verification yet. But it's a good way of, I suppose, making sure that no one's going to remote wipe your device or rack up expensive iTunes bills when you still need to have one, or I think it's maybe two, up to two trusted devices to receive this PIN number on. So it's kind of just an extra level of security, really, which is quite needed, really.
And I understand that as a backup to those trusted devices, obviously if your trusted device is an iOS device and that gets lost, stolen or damaged, then you have a recovery key, which you will have arranged with Apple beforehand. They're actually advising you to print it off and keep it somewhere safe, which I thought was quite interesting in terms of security, because received wisdom tends to be don't print off your passwords, or in this case, recovery keys.
Yeah, definitely. I'd have assumed that if you've not got access to your password and four-digit ID, then that's what the security questions are for, to reset your account. But it looks like with this extra two-step verification, then they're really wanting more people to be secure. But whether or not, like you said, printing something is secure is a different matter, really, isn't it?
From what I've read on this, you print off a recovery key, which you keep somewhere safe under the floorboards or something, I don't know. So should you not be able to access your Apple ID for whatever reason and you don't have access to your trusted devices, then you use this recovery key. This is moving away, as I understand it, from the security questions. If you go for this two-step verification, the way I'm understanding it is you no longer have what was your mother's maiden name, what was your first pet, and what was the name of your favourite teacher.
Yeah.
You don't have those anymore. You have this recovery key, and they're suggesting that you print it off. Of course, the makers of 1Password, Agile Bits, I think they're called, are suggesting that you store it in 1Password. And I think that's probably what I'd do, especially if you're using 1Password syncing your database via Dropbox.
Mm.
You can access it from another device.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a good place to put it. The other thing I think it's worth mentioning is if you enable this, I believe Apple are no longer able to reset your password for you.
That's what scares me. If you enable this,
you've got to be very careful. You know, you don't fudge this, otherwise
if you enable this, you lose your trusted devices and you don't have your recovery key, then you're locked out.
Yeah.
This is a lot like File Vault then on the Mac, where if you forget your account password and you don't set a master password and you don't make a note of your recovery key, then you cannot access the data on your Mac, and in effect that Mac is useless until you wipe it. So it sounds like they're moving away to removing the potential for human error, where do you remember the guy from Gizmodo last year whose account was compromised because the guy could answer the security questions, whoever called up Apple? And
yeah, that was a combination of security procedures for Amazon and Apple, where Apple required the last four digits of the credit card, and he was able to get that from the guy's Amazon account.
Yeah, I think maybe they're trying to remove any human element from your iCloud account, so it puts the onus maybe on the user for them to be careful and to make sure that they have everything noted down, so no one could call up and say, guys, look, I can't remember my wife's date of birth or something like that, and any chance I can answer something else, and someone go, okay, maybe you can do. I think they're really trying to shift it away.
So it's removing the possibility for social engineering to get past this sort of security, which, you know, I suppose has to be admired.
It's a good thing. Yeah, it's a good thing.
I don't know whether this is the right way to go. I'm particularly scared if you know, it's completely unrecoverable if you happen to lose your critical pieces of information.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I'm concerned of, because, again, I haven't been able to test it yet, so I actually have, apart from this Apple support article, I don't really know any of the information about it, but what happens if you get your iPhone replaced or you lose it and that was your trusted device? Does the replacement automatically get updated? Does it tie into your iTunes account automatically, or is that old device constantly your trusted device whether or not you were in possession of it anymore?
I'm surmising it may be a bit like, you know, when you kind of authorize a computer with iTunes.
Yeah, I think you have to go to appleid.apple.com.
Deauthorize the device before you get rid of it.
I think Richard's right on that.
Yeah. The 3-day wait, as far as I understand, is to allow it's in case anybody else tries to activate this without you knowing. So, you know, if somebody's trying to sort of say, oh, my phone is the trusted device for this account, when of course it isn't, because it's not your mobile phone, it's somebody else's, it gives you a little bit of delay time to be able to get in touch with Apple and notify them that that's happening, because they email your account all of your emails that you've got registered on your Apple account will be emailed. So it's kind of like just a bit of a safety net.
But how much of a safety net is it, do you think, Richard? Because if, let's suppose, a hacker has got control of one of your devices, or at least they've got control of one of your accounts, and if they've got control of your email account, that's normally pretty critical. That is the key to everything else that you do online normally, or for most people it is, especially if you start sharing passwords between different services. Supposing they've got that, and Apple sends out an email saying, hey, this has been requested, we're going to have a 3-day wait. If you haven't got access to your email at the time because the hacker has, it's a bit of an empty gesture, don't you think?
I've got to be honest, I hadn't thought of that as a possibility.
From the experience I've had, and on the article that Apple have about the frequently asked questions, they say that if you've had any major significant changes to your account information, then there is a waiting period. Now, it's been a bit hit or miss, because some people have reported that they've not had a waiting period, and then some people have, but they don't remember making any changes. The only change I remember making is the date of birth, which I could see as a significant change. Maybe if you've had a password changed recently, but it doesn't really have a time frame. It just says if any significant changes have been made recently, which is quite vaguely worded. So maybe Apple are just adding that extra layer of security if they think, well, your account was changed quite recently and now you want to enable two-step verification. But then again, we never knew about two-step verification until it was announced. So, when I filled the form in and to submit for two-step verification, I wasn't asked about any of my devices or at that stage. All I clicked was enabled two-step verification and then received a message saying you're going to wait 3 or 4 days until it's kicked in effectively. So
there must be when you get that, it must ask you what device you want to use and what number and so on. I think it's a good time as well for people just to have a think about their account, because it made me think twice about my password that I use for my Apple ID, because I've had that as well years, long before I was as security conscious as I am now, and I'd picked something fairly easy and quick to type in, you know, just being buying apps, and you just think, oh god, here we go, password again. So I've changed it now, so it's got capitals and numbers and, you know, what do you call them? Icons or whatever, you know, punctuation.
Special characters, yeah.
Special characters, yeah. We didn't have any of those before, so it was probably relatively easy to hack. So it's a good opportunity, I would say, for people to have a think about doing that as well whilst you're on, if you haven't already got a decent strength password.
Yeah, just to add to that as well, part of the requirements for Apple's passwords for an Apple ID now is uppercase, lowercase, a number, and a special character. And I think it's a minimum 8 digits as well.
That's right,
all of those. I always get, I think every 90 days or something, I get my password has expired, and I really don't know why, because I know some people who have had passwords that they've had for a long, long time, but mine tends to expire and Apple actually tell me I need to reset my password.
That's an interesting one, isn't it? Because when you're forced to change passwords on a monthly or quarterly basis, as many employers require you to do for their systems, the tendency is for the person then to choose something that's easier to remember, or to choose something that's incremental. So they'll elephant 99, elephant 100, because it is such a difficulty trying to remember yet another password for something. And when you've been used to the last 3 months of typing in the same password for something, you have that muscle memory effect, and then suddenly it's changed. You've been forced to change it. So the tendency, being human, is to try and do something that we can remember.
Mm. Yeah, especially if you're using 1Password a lot, and I use 1Password to generate random passwords all the time, but I can't do that for my Apple ID because I need to type that into my iPhone. So it has to be something that I can at least remember. It doesn't necessarily need to be a name, but as long as it's something I can type without mistyping it several times where it will then lock my account, it's just got to be something at least memorable, which in that way means it's going to be less secure. It's, you know, less secure than it would have been otherwise.
Well, that's the kicker, isn't it, Jordan? You know, you go for the secure password, the mixture of special characters, upper and lowercase, digits, all sorts of stuff. You got this ultra secure Apple ID password, and you enter it incorrectly 3 times, and it kicks you out.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
So
I think it made me think as well, you know, with having such a simple password for all these years, and I've never experienced that, Jordan. You know, I've had that password since I got my Apple ID, and I just think it made me think as well, you know, maybe that was something that Apple should have done. You know, should they have emailed me and said, actually, you haven't got a very strong password, we recommend that you change that. You know, it's something I've never been prompted to do.
The weird thing was, the only thing I can think that would be causing it was I signed up to the developer program a while ago with my Apple ID, and I don't know if they forced developers to do that. Like you said, you know, it's something you've not experienced, and most of the people I know haven't experienced. But I don't necessarily get a message telling me that it's expired and they need to do a new one. I find all of a sudden I can't log into anything. Mm. And the only way I've been able to find out is if I try and log into iCloud.com, and then that tells me my password has expired. Nothing on OS X, nothing on iOS tells me my password has expired. All it tells me is your password is incorrect and your account is inactive.
You see, Jordan, I have a diary event scheduled once a quarter to see if I can hack your account.
That's the worst thing as well, because if somebody does just decide, oh, I know his Apple ID, I'm just going to type random things in, it's enough to bring down, you know, I use that iCloud on a daily basis, it's enough to bring down my email and my contact. So something like that, it's an inconvenience, but it's something that anyone could do to anybody else, which you'd think with something like iCloud, which they are trying to push as such a big service, that maybe don't necessarily limit the account straight away because someone's failed to attempt, but maybe send an alert, send a warning to this trusted device, even saying someone's trying to get into your account. Maybe you want to think about being password.
Now that sort of thing does happen. A couple of years ago, I was locked out of my Royal Bank of Scotland internet banking because somebody else had tried three times to enter their banking account with my user number. And because they'd entered my user number three times and it didn't match their login credentials, it locked my account.
Oh, no.
And I didn't know until I contacted RBS to say, why won't you let me into my account? So that is particularly frustrating. Now, my Apple ID, I'll give all the hackers out there listening to this a clue. My Apple ID is 13 characters long. It's a mixture of punctuation letters, upper and lower case, and digits. And I can remember it. Am I unusual in this respect?
No, I think when you said about muscle memory before, I forced myself to remember my passwords. As soon as I change a password, I have to go through the rigmarole of setting up my iPad and iPhone again. So after a couple of minutes, I eventually start to remember the password. I'll need the keypad in front of me to do it. If you asked me what my password was now, I don't think I could tell you. I wouldn't want to tell you, but I don't think I could literally know without having a keyboard in front of me.
I mean, that is very interesting. It's like when you dial telephone numbers, you know, back in the days when we used to remember the numbers for people we dialed before mobile phones that store all this information, you could find your way around the keypad very, very quickly. You didn't necessarily know which numbers you were dialing. You just dialed them. It's that muscle memory effect, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm.
So I did have something else to say on Apple IDs, but I forget. The interesting thing about Apple's implementation of this two-step verification is it does seem to be quite different to the way Google has done it. Mm. But then, at the moment, there's no love lost between Apple and Google, is there? So I sort of understand, you know, why Apple's being stubborn about this. But personally speaking, I use Gmail a lot, and I find the Google authentication, I've got the Authenticator app on my iPhone, and I get a 6-digit code, and I've got to type that in within a particular time frame if I'm logging into Gmail. And I find that very easy to understand and very easy to use. Mm. The Apple ID, I think just from our discussion, here's three of us who know something about Apple stuff and OS X, and we're having difficulty getting our heads around the way that Apple has implemented two-step verification because it's so different to what others are doing.
Yeah.
Does anyone get an email telling them to do this?
To implement two-step verification?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so, no. I think it's a choice that each Apple ID user can make themselves.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because you would think that Apple would recommend you do it.
It's going to be a big support headache.
Do you think they'll slowly roll it out, sort of thing?
Well, I think they will do because I mean the two-step verification system is currently being offered in the States, UK, Australia, Ireland, and New Zealand.
What I mean,
additional countries will be added over time.
What I mean by that, Johnny, is people obviously, you know, there's people like ourselves that are on Twitter and what have you, and we're very aware of all these kind of things, and it spreads by sort of word of mouth and social media, and I'm just wondering whether they're kind of using this as a bit of a test bed.
Maybe they are. I mean, for instance, my parents, I was there at the weekend, neither of them have heard about two-step verification on Apple IDs.
No.
I think they'd both find it pretty difficult to understand, and I think that that's going to be the case for a lot of people, really.
I mentioned it to people at work as well, and they were completely clueless about it. They hadn't heard anything either. So,
I mean, I wonder how many people are using two-factor authentication for Google.
Google even, yeah.
I mean, I use it on two. I use it on a work account because I have to, and I use it on my Gmail account. I have other accounts with Google, and I haven't implemented it on those yet. Mm-hmm. It is a bit of a pain in the ass to set up on different devices when you're setting up your email for an email client or whatever. But once you know how to do it, it's a fairly straightforward process.
Mm.
This Apple ID, I'm still having difficulty getting my head around.
Yeah, it's an optional system, which means they're not forcing everyone to do it. But I was just thinking, a lot of people who have an iPod or an iPad, sorry, and an iPhone, that's probably their only Apple device for a lot of people. So, and that'll be their only trusted device, which means, I think for a lot of people, especially those who do buy an iPad as their primary device, it's kind of redundant, really. It's not something they'd really need to use, since the verification codes are just go back to the device. I mean, it'd be useful if, as long as nobody's logging in via, say, appleid.apple.com or I forgot or something, but I think because it is an optional service and, you know, they're not forcing everyone to do it, they're probably wanting, I think Richie said it before, where they're using it as sort of a test bed, so maybe they're just slowly bringing this in for, I don't know, maybe something else in the future. Maybe they're just testing the waters to see, is this going to be a good system, or maybe they're thinking about something else.
Do you think it was designed by Scott Forstall?
I actually think it was probably designed because of Scott Forstall. He probably knows a few passwords of some guys in Apple.
Now, I wonder, I mean, I think you made an interesting point there, Jordan. A lot of people, their introduction to Apple will be via an iPhone or an iPad. They might just have the one device. And with the iOS devices, it is now possible to set them up without having to plug them into a computer and connect them to iTunes. That's been the case for the last couple of years. So you have to question the value of this two-step verification in the case where the person only has the one device. Perhaps we miss that a little bit because, you know, we have a number of devices because we're interested in this sort of stuff. You know, I have three iOS devices on my desk. I've got a Mac on my desk and two Macs underneath my desk. I don't think I'm normal in this respect.
Did you rip off an Apple store recently?
I did, but that's a different story. You'll have to go back to a previous episode for that. So, okay, Apple IDs, that's two-step verification, which was introduced last week. And I think they still have some distance to go so that it's easily understood by the normal computer user. What else have we got to talk about, chaps? Who's up next?
We've got Kevin Lynch, who's off to Apple from Adobe. He was their chief technical officer at Adobe, and he was quite one of the proponents of Flash, and was took it upon himself to really push the fact that Adobe Flash is the future, and, you know, lamented that it wasn't necessarily on Apple devices, and he's now moving to Apple as was it chief of technology? Technology chief? Chieftain? Something like that? VP of technology, that was it.
I hate to be incredibly superficial, but I've just taken one look at the picture of this guy, and this is not an Apple guy.
He looks like a PC guy, doesn't he?
There is no way he's going to fit in an Apple. Or either he's going to have laser surgery or something. You know,
do you think he's going to go the way of the Browett?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. He's going to last 6 months, isn't he?
Yeah.
I don't want anything Adobe-esque touching Apple whatsoever.
Did you see the video of him that he made with
the Mythbusters
original
video?
Sorry?
Is this the Mythbusters video?
Yes, it is.
No, I haven't, no.
He made a video with another guy at Adobe, Mythbusters. They're talking about Flash running on mobile devices and there being no good reason for it not to run on an iPhone. And they just have this stupid sort of sketch where they're doing crazy things and blowing up iPhones and all sorts, you know, pretending to get Flash to work on it. it was very derogatory towards the iPhone.
It was. It was even more of a shock that he was in it and Apple have still hired the guy. I mean, don't get me wrong, I mean, Flash does have its uses and it's not quite dead yet, but the sooner it goes, I think the better for everyone, really. But with Flash, the iPhone's been out since 2007, and when Steve Jobs wrote that open letter about Adobe Flash saying, look, there's other standards out there that just make Flash quite redundant, jailbreaking has been around for quite a while, so there was nothing stopping Adobe from getting an iPhone, jailbreaking it to have full access, and developing their own version of Flash and going, look, this is how well Flash can run on the iPhone. And they never did that. They were challenged to do that time and again, and all they would say is, Flash for mobile is great. Look at these devices. And even some of the other developers, some of the other manufacturers of Android phones, and I think even Nokia with the N95 going back quite a few years said, yeah, it'll run Flash, but I wouldn't bother. It's, you know, it's peak slow. It's not worth it. But it will do it.
And it eats battery.
Yeah, it'll kill your battery.
Yeah, definitely. And I think Flash being on, not being on iOS has always been a good thing. And I think, like you said, where is it going to last? Is it going to be another Broward? I think a lot of people are saying yes. It just doesn't seem to be a good fit for Apple.
No.
Do you think that we need to question Paul O'Grady's judgment on this?
we'll see how he fits, I guess. But if he goes as well, then that really does make you think, what's he playing at? You know, is he not a good judge of character, sort of thing?
Well, you have to wonder, especially after the Scott Forstall debacle, the issue with John Browett, who's now swinging handbags at Monsoon, and now we've got this Harry Potter lookalike coming in.
Yeah. I think his mum cut his fringe by the looks of it.
I heard he still lives at home with his mum.
He's going to have a great first day on campus, isn't he?
He is, definitely.
I heard, not in relation to Flash, but in relation to Java, which I think we can safely lump in the same bucket, somebody likened, what was it? They likened Snow to Java updates. The first one's quite interesting and exciting, but they soon become quite annoying.
Mm.
So, anyway, I don't want to talk about Flash anymore.
Nope. Manga, anyone?
Well, what's manga?
It's a form of graphic art popular in Japan. And somebody is penning a Steve Jobs manga cartoon at the moment, which is quite astonishing. And I'm surprised that Apple lawyers haven't jumped all over this.
I think it's because they can't understand it. I've seen the hieroglyphics and the speech bubbles.
But it's taken from the point of view of Walter Isaacson and how...
The official biographer of Steve Jobs.
Yes. I'm assuming people know these things. If there's anybody who hasn't read the
I'm doing this for Neil Cochrane's benefit.
Yeah, if anyone hasn't read the biography, then go get yourself a copy and beat yourself around the head with it.
Richard, I've not read it.
Oh, for God's sakes, Johnny, what? Are you serious?
Seriously, I've not read it.
Right, that's your job tomorrow.
Well, I just look at the pictures. That's why this manga one interests me.
So it's told from the point of view of kind of the story of how they worked together to write the book, as far as I can understand. But yeah, really.
Just
bizarre.
How much Japanese can you understand, Richard?
Absolutely none.
Konnichiwa?
I know konnichiwa. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. I don't know how to spell it, though.
Yeah. So, it's just interesting. And like I say, I'm surprised that the lawyers haven't had some say in this, really. Or, Steve's estate. But then again, he was very keen on Japanese things. So maybe that's why they're letting it go.
Apparently, it's also officially licensed adaptation of the biography.
Oh, well, there you go.
Which... Again, like you said, it's a bit surprising, but maybe it's a way to... Maybe it's a cultural thing. You know, I've never been to Japan, but if manga is as big as everyone tells me about, then maybe this is a good way for them to try and get a lot of people interested in it. I actually didn't believe the story when I first saw it. This is the first time I've seen it and thought, oh, this must be some sort of guy has just drawn it as a... You know, throwback to us, you know, as a contribution, but I didn't realise it was actually official in any way. So that'd be interesting to see what it would look like when it's complete.
I wonder if we're getting somebody to do an English version of it.
That's the book, surely. Isn't it? Isn't this just an is this an alternative way of reading the book? Isn't this just, or is this additional to the book? Is it something that would be with it? I honestly have no idea how what manga is, in all honesty. I just know it's Japanese cartoons.
Well, it's different. It's kind of almost showing it from Walter Isaacson's point of view. Well, it does actually, that's what it says on this article. The manga, told from Isaacson's point of view, begins when Jobs asks the biographer to write his life story. So it's viewing it from his perspective.
It's quite interesting, and just as well that somebody's writing the story about the point at which Jobs asked Isaacson to write his story.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So it might be interesting, actually, in a way.
So the book is someone else's description of Steve Jobs' life story, and the manga is somebody else's description of somebody else's description of Steve Jobs' life story.
This is all made up, isn't it? Interestingly, the series will be serialised over the coming months in female comic magazine Kiss, which is published by Japan's largest manga publisher.
Yeah, right.
So it's interesting, you know, to put it in that magazine. You know, obviously a different target audience from the one you might expect.
Yeah, unless there's a lot of love for Steve Jobs and the Japanese girls. I don't know. No idea.
I think we should move on.
Let's move on.
What are we talking about next?
You seemed interested, Johnny, by your comment there about this Hyperoptic.
Yeah, Hyperoptic. I just caught this. Did I catch this from one of your tweets today, Richard?
Nope.
Did I catch this from your entry onto the show notes, Richard?
Yes.
I knew that it was something to do with you. Hyperoptic. This is very interesting because it sort of comes on the back of Barn, which is Broadband for the Rural North, which is a not-for-profit organisation. Local people basically put together their own fibre optic network because neither BT nor Virgin, who are the incumbents in the UK, would supply them with broadband given their remote nature. Hyperoptic, this looks like a company. It's not for profit, but they're going for the gigabit fibre that Broadband for the Rural North is already using. And as far as I can tell, they're starting off in London, or they've started off in London already, and they've been going into high-density areas such as blocks of flats or apartments, I would expect, and installing fibre connectivity that gives people 20 meg, 100 meg or 1 gigabit Ethernet, which is really quite incredible. And they're inviting people to get in touch. They're obviously wanting to put this into the areas where they can make the most money. So it's going to be densely populated areas, I'd expect.
Mm. Yeah.
Very, very interesting. I mean, I'd jump at the chance of gigabit broadband. I mean, you're downloading stuff in no time at all. It's not particularly Mac related, as you said in the show notes, but I think from a technology point of view, and the fact that all of us use broadband these days, I mean, this is so much faster than the fibre that I'm on at the moment, where I only get about 48 meg.
Yeah, that's incredibly fast, and just the idea that at least there's a bit of competition out there as well, you know. Putting the others to maybe sort of feel like they should up their game a little bit.
Well, I hope there is.
I wish there was a way that people could more easily, you know, club together and say, right, the broadband is shocking in our area, we want it, and go to a service provider and say, right, you know, what do we have to get it?
You know, I had a look at the availability checker on Hyperoptic today, and it's not so much an availability checker because it doesn't tell you that you have any availability, or it certainly didn't for me down here in Brighton, which I expected, but they're inviting you to register now, and they're actually saying club together with your neighbours, neighbouring businesses, whatever, if everybody registers, if there's demand, then they'll put this in. And, you know, we only need to go back a few years, and this is how BT was rolling out fibre in the exchanges. Mm-hmm. They're inviting people to register their interest.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I actually worked in the village I live near Leeds. They were one of the first to get the new BT Infinity fibre to the cabinet system, where they all club together and they all put in a petition to be one of the 10 rural areas to get involved with it, and they got that. So unfortunately, I live on one of the only streets that don't have that, so I don't get the fibre, but I still get a decent speed. But no, down the road, they can get 40, 50, 60 meg quite easily, and there's BT Infinity signs everywhere. So like you said, Johnny, I think with hyperoptic, if there is enough demand, it's just a question of, are they rolling out this fibre from using traditional BT systems? Can they do that in the same way BT Infinity's rolled out? And if so, you know, they could be a worthwhile alternative. One of the investors is the managing director, Dana Toback. I think that's how you say her name. She founded Bee back in 2004. So she was also involved with another company that did one of the highest speed broadband services around.
Well, Bee Broadband, at the time, they were offering something like 22, 24 megabits over copper lines, which was just way beyond what anybody else was doing. And the thing is, their customer service and their broadband service were both very, very good as well. I did use Bee Internet for a time at home, and that business was subsequently bought out by O2, and more recently, just in the last couple of weeks, that's then been bought by Sky. So clearly a very successful business. You know, I mean, this looks absolutely incredible. I mean, 20 meg service for, I'll find it now, £12.50 a month, 100 meg for 25 a month. I mean, that's faster than I'm getting on BT Infinity at the moment. And for pretty much the same price. 1 gig, they're calling it hypersonic, 50 quid a month. Oh, I'd be tempted to stretch to that, wouldn't you?
Yep.
I think the problem with the 1 gig would be you're limited by the speed of the server you're downloading from, which would be, I think, a first for ever, really. It's normally your speed is what limits you to download the content.
But so basically you'd be sucking harder than they can push.
Exactly. Yeah.
I really despair sometimes when you read like the article I read, and there's a quote in here, something along the lines of, oh yes, it's more than anybody's ever going to need. No, because that's always the way that people think initially, isn't it? And then over time, you start saying, well, actually, no, this is too slow now.
That's probably what they said back in the 50s when they were unloading 1 kilobyte of RAM from an aeroplane, the size of an industrial washing machine.
Who's going to need all that?
Yeah, that's right. Who's going to need all that? I mean, one gig hypersonic to download, what's this? Download an MP3 album, approximately 70 meg, half a second, compared to 80 seconds, you know, on normal UK speeds.
You look at speeds like that and you're thinking about, you know, sort of 4K television over broadband, aren't you?
Well, yes. I mean, it's getting to that point. Perhaps it then becomes possible, as long as, Jordan says, as long as, you know, the servers can push the information
fast enough.
Fast enough. I mean, an HD movie, 5.2 gig. Now, an HD is only 1080p, isn't it? UK average speeds, that would take 1 hour, 38 minutes to download, according to Hyperoptic. 42 seconds on their 1 gig service.
Oh, my God.
I've just read their business page as well, and they're offering obviously the 1 gig service, which is 1 gig upload as well, which for businesses would be insane. It says go Hyperoptic, not only can your entire office download files at 1 gig, everyone can upload at 1 gig too. That's ridiculous.
That's insane.
Well, that's going to help out a lot of businesses, I think.
Yeah.
Especially all these, you know, media businesses, you know, those doing videos and graphic design, they're dealing with very large files.
Yeah.
Well, rather than direct people to the show notes, have a look at hyperoptic.com, because it really is quite interesting. And if everybody in my area would register their interest, please, because I would like this. for my birthday.
Same here. I'm going to put my name down.
I'm putting everyone's name down. I don't care if they want it or not.
Put all my neighbours' names down.
That's it. Now, okay, let's move on. My favourite app launcher, the only one that's ever really been on my radar, is Alfred. Alfred has just come out with version 2 in the last couple of weeks. But something that's popped up on Mac Rumors yesterday... Quicksilver. This was, Jordan might be able to tell us something about Quicksilver. I've been aware of it for the last 3.5 years. It's a 10-year-old project, which has been closed source and open source. Have you used Quicksilver, Jordan?
Yeah, I used it a long, long time ago. Probably when it was first released, actually. It kind of fell off the radar. It was, at first, like Alfred, for those who don't know, it's a keyboard launcher and sort of, you can run a lot of tasks via the keyboard, so I mainly use it to launch applications because I prefer just to start typing in, say, iPhoto or mail than having to go to the applications folder and load it. I don't tend to have much in my dock except anything I'm running. Quicksilver came before Alfred a long time before and was always in development. A while ago, development kind of got delayed significantly, I think indefinitely, when the original developer, unfortunately I can't remember his name, he actually moved to Google and subsequently released something called the Google Quick Launch Bar, which was basically Google's own version of Quicksilver, and that didn't last, much like many of Google's services nowadays. But they've recently released it to version 1 after nearly 10 years.
So it's been in Quicksilver.
It's been in beta for so long, I'd forgot it existed.
Just like a Google product, really.
Exactly. The thing is, Alfred has been out, and Alfred 2 is now out, and both of those were done in, I think, the last 2 years.
I think Alfred's been going a little longer than that. I think it's about 3 years now.
3 years now? Well, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, even in 3 years, Alfred is now on its second major version, and that does spend some time in development, and Quicksilver has only just launched. You know, credit to the guys who have actually finished development of it, but I'd be surprised to know anyone who really does use it much now, with it being in development for so long.
How does it compare to Alfred? I mean, is it very similar? Is it a different beast altogether? I mean, they both launch applications from the keyboard. That's something I like. I like to just navigate around the keyboard, a couple of keys, and it's launched. I can find things very quickly. Saves having to drag the mouse cursor all the way up to Spotlight to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's been so long since I've used Quicksilver, I don't think it'd be a fair comparison, because it would have been, as I said, about 6 or 7 years ago when I'd last used it. But it was scriptable as well, the same way Alfred currently has workflows and used to have extensions as well. So I think they both operate in a very similar way. Quicksilver, you were able to, I think, shortcut even more. So you could start typing in, say, a command, and then you could then type a single letter, I think maybe after a space, to, for example, find a new file, and you could do all that within, say, 4 or 5 keystrokes. But
given that it's been in beta for 10 years, there was confusion over whether the project was continuing or not. It was closed source, then it was open source. It's now been finished off, and here it is. Alfred's been established for at least 3 years now. It's on version 2. It has a huge following. It's very, very popular. In fact, I just upgraded to Alfred version 2 this evening. I paid £20 for my Mega Supporter license. It's a cracking piece of software. It's getting active development. You know, the developers are working on it all the time. Have people just moved on from Quicksilver, do you think? Does it have a core following? You know, is it too little too late?
I think it does have a core following with, a small but dedicated number of users. I'd moved on to Google Quick Search because at one point Quicksilver was so unreliable for me, and it was just really buggy that I needed to move on to something else. And so I used Google Quick Launch for a while. Then I stopped using it altogether. Then when Alfred came on the scene, I started using Alfred. And since Alfred was first available, I've used it ever since. I use it constantly, every day. So I personally never moved back to Quicksilver. I'm like you, I purchased the licenses for supporting them and also getting the extra features. So whether or not Quicksilver will see a version 2 remains to be seen, but I would be surprised if it does make another major milestone. Not that it's a bad application, I think it's great, but most 10-year-old software that's been in development to hit version 1 doesn't tend to really hit version 2 relatively quickly. So I'd be surprised if...
Well, there's the confidence thing, isn't there? Are people really going to want to stick with a piece of software that's been in beta for so long and doesn't look as though it's getting active development?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And Alfred has always been free, but there is a definite paid-for option which people take in advantage of, which means it funds the developer, which means he's not doing it in his spare time. Was it 18 months, 2 years ago? He quit his full-time his job to take Alfred on full-time. So there is an active development of Alfred. I see a lot of new versions of Alfred coming out, and I continue to use those.
I think that active development of software like Alfred gives consumers the confidence to actually pay for the license because they feel as though they're getting real value for money.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I agree with that completely.
Richard, what's your thoughts on Quicksilver?
I'd never heard of it, and I'll not be using it.
Okay, that's good. Right. That's Quicksilver done. Before we move on to hot hardware this week, Jordan, Richard's interested to know what sort of hardware you use. What's your Mac setup there? We heard that it was Windows 8 at the end of the last show.
It's close. It's Windows ME, I think. I use an 11-inch MacBook Air as my main machine with an external display. Although it's an 11-inch MacBook Air, it rarely moves away from the desk, so it's constantly attached to an external display and keyboard and mouse. I think it's the entry-level one, actually, just with 8 gigabytes of RAM, so there's nothing special about it, really. But it's by far the best Mac I've ever had. And I had a 13-inch MacBook Pro before this, and you know, whilst I wish the screen may be Retina, but I bought this knowing full well there was a Retina MacBook Pro. So I'm happy with my choice, and I love it a bit.
So why did you go for a MacBook Air if your work is mainly static?
I've always used external displays with a laptop, but I don't really like having a desktop because there's always that need that I need to take a computer away with me, whether I'm going to go and visit a client or whether I need to work somewhere else. And sometimes it's nice just because I work from home, it's nice just to get out with the laptop and go somewhere else with it. So it
gives you that option of portability then.
Yeah. And because it's so small and portable, I don't have to worry about having a big bag with it. And it's extremely light. The MacBook Pro, I used to have the 13-inch, even though it was the smallest laptop at the time, it was still pretty heavy after a while. So the 11-inch was great. And, you know, sometimes it's nice just to sit and, the iPad is great, but it's not great for everything. So if I'm going to hammer away at a few emails, I might take the computer downstairs and veg out in front of the TV and have the MacBook Air with me. But predominantly it stays on the desk attached to a big display. And the fact it can go to a big display is good enough for me, really.
The thing that puts me off about portable machines, because you know my work tends to be at desks anyway, whether it's home or at work, the thing that's putting me off the portable machines is the battery life. You know, if I just have a machine plugged in, day out for 3 or 4 years, the battery's going to become knackered.
Well, with the newer MacBook batteries, ever since they moved to the integrated ones, there's no real right or wrong way to charge it. All they recommend is every now and again, maybe a month or two, just drain the battery and charge it again. But they tend to look after themselves, so you'll tend to get the same life span out of a MacBook if you've got it on your desk for most of the time, say 4 or 5 years, then if you were using it every day, well, maybe the battery would wear out a little bit more if you're using it every day, but it looks after itself. So after a while, it won't even charge the battery. It'll just bypass it completely and just charge your computer up and power that instead. So, I mean, I've not noticed any battery problems with it, and I've had it for the better part of 8 months now, and it's still a good 4 or 5 hours battery life, and that's with it in constant use on Wi-Fi with, you know, Dropbox going on in the background and, you know, and all that. So the battery life is still fantastic, and the fact it's rated for about 5 years is good.
Okay. I mean, you know, the operating system is going to move on so much in that time anyway, isn't it?
Yeah. Although I was saying about the battery, I did get the battery replaced about a month ago, so I probably shouldn't tout the benefits of the battery that much.
So are you using an Apple Cinema display with it or some other screen?
No, I'm using an AOC display. As much as I'd love to have a Thunderbolt display, I can't justify it. £600 for a display is a little much. Actually, I don't really use any external Apple peripherals. It's an AOC display. It's a Logitech keyboard and trackball and a set of Logitech speakers. I'm not a fan of the Apple keyboard, simply because I prefer to have an extra number pad, but I do like the wireless capability, so I went with the Logitech instead. And I don't like trackpads and I don't like mice. I'm a trackball person. I think I'm one of the four people left in the world who use a trackball.
I think it's just as well, really, Jordan, that you're not particularly fussy, isn't it?
Well, yeah. No, trackball is always a given.
I've heard other people express similar views on the keyboards, and a chap I know, I believe, uses a Logitech wireless keyboard for similar reasons to you. So, you know, not everybody goes for the Apple wireless keyboard. I actually quite like it. I've got used to it. And in fact, I went to use a Lenovo PC that I have in the office the other day, and these great big chunky mechanical keys, it was very difficult to use, having got used to the low-profile Scrabble tiles of the Bluetooth keyboard. It's quite unusual going back to one of those, you know, traditional keyboards. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I remember seeing those Apple keyboards when they were first released. And do you remember the old Apple Pro keyboards, translucent white ones?
Yeah, with the white ones, yeah.
Looking at those now, I'm surprised how anyone could have used them and not developed RSI or any sort of wrist injury. They were dreadful keyboards in comparison. I like the fact there's very little travel because it makes, you know, I'm not a fan of clicky keyboards and all these things that, you know, heavy keyboards, you know, weighted keys, whatever, just, you know, a little bit of travel, that's fine. You know, if the keyboard does that, I'm happy.
Excellent. Okay. Richard, do you want to ask anything about Jordan's setup there?
Do you find much use? I know it's not kind of connected, but I'm just interested if you have much use for your iOS devices in your workflow.
Yeah, so I have an iPhone 5 and an iPad mini. I did have an iPad 2, which I put on eBay straight after the iPad mini announcement. The iPad 2 was great, but and I occasionally play games with it and I read a lot on it, so Instapaper and RSS feeds. It sounds like such a first world problem, but it just got too heavy after a while.
Try the iPad 3, mate.
Is that heavier?
Yes. Yeah, it's much heavier than the iPad 2.
You two need to get down the gym.
the first thing that struck me when I did pick up the iPad Mini was just like, oh my god, this is so light. I was just sold on that alone. Anyway, sorry.
You two remind me, I was reading Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy to my son this evening, and it's talking about Zaphod Beeblebrox's trying to operate the radio in his spaceship, the Heart of Gold, and the fact that, you know, radio controls used to be dials and knobs that you pressed and twisted, and then they moved to touch-sensitive, where you just stroke your finger over them, and they'd operate. And that's where we are now with the iOS devices, and that's where Microsoft is with having your dirty mitts on their screens. But the Heart of Gold used something where you just wave your hands in the general direction of the controls and then just hope that it worked. That's what you two remind me of, you know, as little muscle action as possible to operate these things.
Yeah. I won't be happy until my Johnny.
You see that, Johnny? That exists now, doesn't it? The Samsung phone does that.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
This really is infinite improbability, isn't it?
Yeah, it's coming.
Okay. All right. Now, last section of the show, probably, is hot hardware or software. Now, this week, Richard's chosen something, and I really don't know what it is because I've looked at it. I don't even know that I hate it yet. What is it, Richard?
Well, it isn't. I'm really sorry. To be fair, nobody else has put anything else in, but this was just something that I saw, and we're kind of on an arty theme this week with manga and now this, but basically, I've come across this guy who's an artist, and he creates works of art by having large sheets of bubble wrap, you know, the stuff that you love playing with and making the poppy noises.
Mm-hmm.
And he injects each cell of the bubble wrap with coloured paint to create a work of art.
And I'm looking at the one here of a chap who looks very much like Steve Jobs. And that's really quite interesting, isn't it? You could do this much easier with a filter in Pixelmator, of course.
Yeah. But it's incredibly good. You know, it's really well done how this guy's done it. And it's interesting, if you go on to the chap's website, it's bradleyhart.ca, and read his sort of artist statement about why, how and why he does this. It's quite intriguing, really. He talks about the kind of like throwaway aspect of society and how he likes the fact that he's using such a fragile medium to create a work of art and take such a long time over it. I kind of get where he's coming from, you know. All it would take is for somebody just to scrumble that up, and that's like probably months of work destroyed in a split second. But there's lots of other people on there. But yeah, it was the Steve Jobs one that caught my eye.
This guy is a true artist, isn't he? The idea of using bubble wrap came from a few experiences where overzealous museum security guards instructed patrons not to touch works of art and left a leftover roll of bubble wrap. You know, he's got all the artistic reasoning behind it as well. But to be honest, you know, just looking at a couple of those images there, like I say, you could create similar effects using a filter in Pixelmator or Photoshop, but these really do look very, very good.
Yeah,
very interesting. He's got photos. He's got one looks like L'Arc de Triomphe there. One looking like a test card from a television. It's either that or an interesting blanket.
It's one of those things, I think, that would probably look so much better in real life.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, then because like you say, looking at it on a computer, you just think, well, that could just be a pixelated photograph or something. But
which is how I'd do it.
the jokes on us of all low resolution GIF files.
Yeah. What do you think of this, Jordan?
I like it. I think it looks quite cool. It reminds me of the pictures where what was that Steve Jobs one where they were made up of tiny pictures of other Steve Jobs or other Apple products or something. But I'd be worried in case, you know, it'd be great to hang on your wall, but you'd want to make sure the frame fits perfectly. You wouldn't want a frame that's a little, not quite deep enough for it. Otherwise,
it's too tight.
Yeah, it's not going to be pleasant. You know, the last thing you want is to look at Steve Jobs and look like he's bleeding from his ears and it's just the paint leaking.
I really like the fact that Richard has chosen something this week for the medium of radio, the medium of a podcast, something that is visual.
Yeah, I've done it again.
So, well, Richard, hot or not?
I think it's fabulous. Yeah, hot.
Jordan?
Hot, yeah.
Richard, what's my role in this?
To throw in the casting aspersion of doubt.
I think this would make really interesting packaging material when you're sending valuable stuff or fragile stuff through the post.
That's it, they should wrap every iMac in one of these.
That'd be terrifying if you're not expecting it. Just take a 27-inch iMac out of the box and you've just got pictures of Steve Jobs staring at you.
especially if it was the photo of the Walter Isaacson biography.
I think that this is pretty cool.
Yeah, it is.
Which is hot, isn't it? Cool is hot.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is very good. Bradleyhart.ca, go and have a look at that. They're really quite impressive work. Clearly, the chap's got far too much time on his hands. Being an artist, he's probably unemployed. maybe he sells his work, I don't know. Go and ask him. It'd be interesting to stick up in the lounge, perhaps, until all that paint runs down the wall and over the mantelpiece, and then you've got a bit of a DIY disaster. But it was nice while the thought lasted. Name checks. Said hello to Neil Cochran once already. He's off down the boozer tonight. He should be listening to Late Night Loaf on Mint FM.
Already
started 12 minutes ago. We're missing that. Murphwiz on Twitter was in touch with me during the week, singing his praises of Jordan. Richard, you and I are redundant. The show comes from Jordan next week. not from Jordan. That's too far away.
The state of Jordan. Yeah,
yeah. It will be Jordan that's doing it. So there we go. And I think that's all we've. I don't know. Has anybody been in touch with you two about the show last week?
No, I think I mentioned to you. I talked to Neil Cochran about the show.
There you go. That's his three mentions. His statutory three mentions. On Back to the Mac. If anybody else listening would like three mentions on Back to the Mac episode 16, do get in touch with us on Twitter. You can reach me at Johnny_Winter. Richard, where can they reach you?
At Rich Harkness is the best place to get me.
And Jordan?
At Jordan Merrick.
At State of Jordan, next to Israel. aboutme.com/JohnWinter. Jordan's got a very interesting website. Jordan, tell people what that is.
It's sparsebundle.net. It's basically a blog more than anything else. So have a read. It's mainly Apple related or tech related. Warnings that it does contain opinions, so just a warning there.
And Richard, you've got a blog as well, haven't you?
I do. It's Are You Getting It? .co.uk.
Okay, and you can also follow us at Q Broadcasting on Twitter, at BTTM Podcast. And the website for Q Broadcasting is q.am, q-u-e.am. You can see us on there also. Any final thoughts, anybody?
No. Listen to James.
Okay. We're off to listen to Late Night Loaf. We'll see you next week. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye, chaps.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Johnny.
See you later now.
That was Back to the Mac from the Q Broadcasting Network. You can follow us on Twitter at BTTM Podcast or at Q Broadcasting, or find us on the internet at q.am. That's q-u-e.am. Intro and outro music is used with the kind permission of Tariq Greenfield, composer and producer. Find him on the internet, www.tdmss.com. Thanks for listening.
Apple Macintosh.
Right, I was just about to say, no, that's fine, that's absolutely fine. Okay,